So this evening, I would like to look at meditation for life and to look at that in a different aspect. First, to see meditation in terms of all our life, so that in a way we don't see it so much as a special or exotic activity, and then, you know, we get what we want out of it and then we move on. I feel if we see meditation as a quick fix. Sometimes people come to a meditation retreat because they want to fix something. And sometimes it gets fixed, but most of the time not. And again, to me, this is not really what so much the meditation is for, but it's kind of really for the whole of our life. And through our life, we will cultivate meditation in different ways. So we will, of course, experience possibly meditative state. We might have mystical experiences, but generally those are kind of short. And I think the most important effect is that de-grasping, that releasing. And so at that level, I would say that the meditation is actually food for the organism, food for our being. And then it has different aspects. There is an aspect of learning, of opening, of letting go. And so it's a lifelong journey. And so I think we have to be careful to think that at any given time, either because there is a big insight or because we have a special meditative state, to think that we have arrived, that this is it. Because often I have the feeling we seem to be looking for perfection. And I don't think that's what meditation is about. I think meditation is just in a way to develop ourselves, to develop our potential for wisdom and compassion. And so in a way, you never arrive at a point where you have developed all the wisdom, all the compassion you are possible of, because there is new circumstances, new conditions. And also to see that because you've done meditation or because you have had some great meditative state, doesn't mean that you are sorted, that you have no problem or that you don't cause any problem. I remember once I was living in community, in a Buddhist community, and there was one person who had meditating long time in Burma and many deep meditative experiences. Also, that person had studied all the books, and that person could explain the book so well. And at the same time, that person was a sociopath. And it was so hard to live with that person. And that person had also done psychology and therapy. And often we thought, what if he had done none of this? Then it would be really bad. So that's the way we made it a little easier for ourselves. So in a way, to me, what was very inspiring with my teacher in Korea is that although he was, you know, a great teacher, he was reputed to have had 3 awakenings, he never stopped meditating, never, ever. He would meditate when we traveled in Europe, he would meditate in the plane, in the train, you know, and he would say to me, and me, I would be so tired, I would just read the paper, he would say, hey, you have to meditate. And I'm, because he would be like this in the plane, I'd say, I'm too tired. Or we would travel, and then he would check on me. So I would hear his steps, I would kind of look like him. And then he would go, and then I would lie down again. But he meditated all the time. And so sometimes I used to say to him, but Master, maybe you should lie down. He said, no, it's so nice to meditate. And you know, and to the last day of his life, he meditated. So to me, this was a great example that really the meditation was a lifelong journey. There was no point where you say, enough, I don't need to do it anymore. I think also this meditation for life is to recognize and appreciate life in this moment and to be more in it. And in a way, not to take life for granted. Because I think often we take life for granted, and because of that, then we everything becomes to the same degree. So we are as upset by a little thing than a big thing. And so in a way, to see if we kind of see more life in the moment, we can think, do I really need to be so upset about this? And if there is something important, then you can say, yes, this. And to me, the way to check is to tell myself, if I were to die tomorrow, would I mention this? And if it's about washing cups, I think, never mind. But if it's about somebody being aggressive, I would say, no way. Even if I die tomorrow, I want to address this now. So in a way, to me, this being more in the moment actually helps us to not make everything the same, but to really see the different conditions, to see the different circumstances. And also it makes us see that sometimes we have a frustration, like a desire to be someone else, the desire to be somewhere else. And this is very painful. And I think the meditation helps us to see that there is no one else to be. There is nowhere else to go. And then we really be with ourselves. And to me, and that's why I think this acceptance of this morning is so important. To in a way accept ourselves, accept our life, does not mean that we're not going to do something to transform it. We can aspire to have a good life, of course. And in the Sigalavaka Sutta, the sutta for the lay people, the Buddha talks about, you know, what is a good life. But in a way, it's to see, to really be with it, to really accept it. And to me, I saw that very clearly a few years ago when my grandmother was still alive, but she was kind of old and she was starting to lose her faculty. And so every afternoon, I would play dominoes with her. I would just, so that my mother could go and do something else. So I would play the domino together. She had by then a different style of playing dominoes. And this was the autumn. And in the autumn, leaves fall. And my grandmother hated leaves on the patio. She thought they were very dangerous. So we were playing domino, and then she would look. There are three leaves on the patio. So I would get up because, you know, she could not really move so well. So I would get up, I would sweep the leaf and then back to the domino. Then five leaves. So get up, sweep, back. Two. So. And so the third time I go and sweep the leaf. And I'm starting to think, this is not really heroic, this, you know, playing dominoes and sweeping leaves repeatedly. And then suddenly I realized that there was nothing else to do, nowhere else to be, to play domino and sweep leaves. And that's what was happening in that moment. And at that moment I was fully, totally with it. And it was so peaceful. It was so restful because there was no desire to do something else. Because often I think we are, would not it be better if I did this? Would not it be better if I was there? Instead of seeing, you know, what is there first before wanting to move away from it. And to me, the meditation, I think we have this tendency to want to be special. I mean, of course, for our mother, possibly for your Jewish mother, you are very special. But we have this feeling that we are the center of the universe. But each person is the center of their universe, not of our universe. This is a problem. So you have all these center of the universe spinning around each other, thinking, I am more important, my center is better, you know? And for a long time, when I was young, I wanted to be special. I wanted to be different. From the age of 10, I wanted to leave home, to travel. And I did not do it because I thought I would upset my parents. So I waited till I was 18. So I wanted to be special. I remember working once in an office and somebody said, "Oh, really, you always want to be special." So obviously it was kind of quite striking. And then I went to Korea and I became a nun there. And there I was the only French nun, French Buddhist nun in Korea. So it was one among 60 million French people. I was the only French nun among the Korean. So it was one among another 60 million people. So I was one among 120 million people. I mean, this is very special. This was my gold medal of specialness. And then I stopped being a nun. And then I wore ordinary clothes. And then one day I thought, this is strange. I feel strange. And I looked and I thought, why am I feeling strange? And I realized it was because nobody was looking at me special. I was just like anybody else. And that was over time, that became wonderful. And to me, meditation is actually helps us to become ordinary, to accept our humanness, to accept our ordinariness. Of course, it's not any ordinariness. It's a meditative, ethical ordinariness. But it's a very common, it's very ordinary, it's very normal. It is not special. We don't lit like a Christmas tree. We don't start to float above the earth. We're just more anchored in the earth, in our life, in our organism. Also, this meditation for life is faith in our potential in this life that we can cultivate, we can train, we can explore, we can experiment. And then we have, of course, the potential for the negative and the positive. And I would say meditation is cultivating the potential for the positive. We cultivate calm, which helps us to develop space around condition and circumstances, and then helps us to respond instead of react. We cultivate openness, so then we can more engage with the world, with others. And that's why we have to be very careful not to use meditation as a way to anesthetize ourselves, as a way to kind of, I am equanimous, nothing matters. Everything is impermanent, who cares? That's not what the meditation is about. And I had a friend who was a monk, and first he was a monk in Thailand. And in Thailand, what he would do is that he would go and meditate on an island with a dog. And by himself on that island, he had a wonderful time. He would get this wonderful meditative state, quiet and clear, spacious, fantastic. No problem with the dog. And then he came back to the monastery, and as soon as there was people, he would get into fights. So then he would find it painful, then he would go back to the island. Fantastic. Back to the monastery. Painful. So then he realized there was something which did not work. Like meditation by himself was fine, but that did not have that transformative effect for him. So then he decided to come to Korea, because in Korea it's a very communal existence. You do everything together. The meditation, eating, everything you do together. He thought, you know, if I live in community, I will be able to work with that problem of relationship. And I had a hard work with him in terms of translation. Often I was called because he was creating trouble. And for me, he was a great teacher. He was a great teacher because as a French person, I used to be quite argumentative. You would say something, I would say the opposite, just for the sake of it. And he used to come to my room and have tea, and within 5 minutes, we used to have an argument. And I thought this was unpleasant after a while. So I thought, but what happens? And I realized he did it on purpose. That's why he had problem with relationship, because he loved picking argument. That was his temperament, his tendency. So then I trained myself. So he would come and he would say, "What about that?" And I would say, "Yes, possibly. One could consider it. Yes, you know." Then he would say, "But what about this?" I would say, "Why not? Yes, possibly." So I would not get hooked. I would not. He would kind of send his thing, and I would just not do anything with it. And then he stopped coming. It was not fun anymore. But for me, it was a great training. So, and also I think the meditation can help us to develop the brightness which is possible within ourselves, the creativity, the responsiveness. And also what we've been doing here, concentration, experiential inquiry, as I mentioned before, as you focus in the meditation, you develop the spaciousness, the calmness, and that helps you to be more quiet and bring more space around things. It's kind of in a way like if in your mind or in your feelings or in your sensation, it's like if this room was full of furniture, there would be very little space. But if there is no furniture whatsoever, then you can move freely. And I think to me, the focusing, that's what happened. That actually the furniture go. They're not kind of all jumbled up, kind of moving about fast in the mind. They're just kind of less. First, there is less furniture, and then they just stay there. They don't impede the space. And then we can see around the furniture, or what's going on here? What kind of furniture is it? What is around it? What impacted it or not? And that's why the focusing is so important, in terms that we don't feed the agitation. We don't feed the confusion. We try to, in a way, de-intensify it. So there is more spaciousness, a little more calmness, a little more stability. Then, of course, you have the experiential investigation in terms of either doing the questioning or either doing the looking at the changing nature. And that, in a way, helps us to develop vividness, clarity, openness, and creativity. And so together, they help us to develop this creative awareness. And then this creative awareness that we've been developing during this week, then we can go and use in our daily life. To me, this is the point, and we have to use it. So the more we use it, the more it grows, the more it develops. For example, when we work, it's interesting to bring creative awareness to working and to kind of look, how do I work? I mean, often we barely started working, that we're already on the next task, already on the next one. And then we feel very busy because we're not present to the work itself. Or you do your work and you're totally somewhere else. So it's very automatic and you're not very present to it. And I think it's very interesting in the when we work to try to really be present and to try to find what is a way that will help me to be present. Is it through the body? Is it kind of, you know, how I hold my body, and I could come back to the body time to time. Like, for example, if you do the computer, after a while, you can get mesmerized by the computer, and then you forget that actually you might have a very bad posture on your chair. And then, in a way, the awareness saying, okay, maybe I should stand up just for a minute now. Or if you work in the garden, I love working in the garden, but I have sciatica, so I must be aware of my body, how I use it, otherwise I will get it. So then the awareness helps me actually to be more careful how I use my body. And also, I think the awareness can be interesting with working in terms of the association of value. I think with work, we can be very identified with our work. I am my work. So if my work is important, I am important. If my work is not important, I am not important. And I think we have to be very careful with that, because it's also the value society gives to our work. And if society says it's not important, we think it's not important. Society said it's fantastic. No. Can you do the job? Can you do it well? Can you do it for yourself satisfyingly? When I came back from being a nun and stopped being a nun and came to live in England, I had no way to earn money. And I had no diploma, I'd never been to university, nothing. And I needed to earn some money. And so somebody came to me and said, oh, you know, you could be a house cleaner. And my heart said, ooh, I used to be, you know, a great nun, one among 120 million people, you know, and now house cleaner, ooh. So there was this depression in the cell. And then I thought, I mean, it's also, and did not like, especially in those days, house cleaning anyway. And then I thought, well, that's the only thing I can do. It's on the spot. It's easy to do. So I decided to do it. And actually, once I started to do it with awareness, with creative awareness, it was fine. I was happy cleaning the bathtub to do it well and properly and do everything. And it was very satisfying as a work. So in a way, to be careful how we, again, back to this comparing mind, if we introduce that notion of comparing, if your job is harmless, if it makes you earn enough money, to think maybe this is enough. Because often we think I must find the one job which I am, which will be my life work. Who knows? I mean, if maybe you have a vocation to be a doctor and you can realize it, but very few people can do that. Nowadays, it's multi-choice. And so in a way, it's a little, what is it I can find and what is it I can do? And I had a friend, recently we were teaching and we did this day retreat, work retreat, which the way it works is that the people come in the morning early, and then we give them some instruction and we do some meditation. Then they go to work, regular work. Then they come back in the evening to review how it went. And so Stephen suggested that they really try to be aware in the work and not be ahead of themselves. And just try to be present, fully present, and do their job. Me, I suggested that they try to be aware of the atmosphere of the office or the group and to see how they could help with right speech in developing more harmony. And then they came back in the evening. And one of the persons said she took Stephen's advice, and generally she said when she works, she feels always busy, stress, and you know, not enough time and things don't. And she said this time, she said, okay, I'll do what he said. I'll be really present, really present. And she thought if she was too present, she would not be efficacious. She found the opposite. When she was present to each thing, so when she was with one thing, she did it. Then she left it. Next thing, she was with it, left it. Next thing, left it. She said, I was not stressed, and I did more than normally I would do. So actually, just this being present added something to the experience. And then there was somebody who was working in a pottery. So there were these five women doing pottery. And she came back and said, you know, generally, I like my job, but I did not like the atmosphere. Because everybody was gossiping, you know, saying nasty things about other people. So being a Buddhist and meditator, she did not join in, but she did not think it was very nice. And so this time she thought, can I do something about this? So she turned to one person and said, don't you think it would be nice to maybe, you know, have maybe more positive, so subject of conversation, things we could explore together. And the other lady said, oh yeah, that would be so nice. You know, I think it's also this gossip is not so good. Then everybody decided the same, and then they had a much better atmosphere. So in a way, to see, to look, what is going on? I had a friend who, every year I saw her once a year, she used to complain about her job. She used to work for a newspaper, terrible job, and it's awful, and I hate it, and people are terrible. And then she decided to learn to do a type of education for children, Montessori schooling. So she did it for 3 years, complained about the job each year. Then the fourth year, I thought, you know, now she's going to change. She's going to become a Montessori teacher. And so I said, oh, how is it then, the teaching? She said, oh, I did not, I still with the newspaper. Really? She said, yeah, now it's great. I said, what happened? She said, well, one day I went in and I decided to really be there in the moment, to really see how were the people right here, right now? How was the job right here, right now? And actually, they were fairly nice and it was fairly okay. And it was interesting because she, it sounded like she changed the inner landscape. And of course, sometimes we have to change the job if it's too hurtful or difficult, but sometimes it's also looking at the inner landscape. Then also, we can see if we can bring the creative awareness in our relationships. And to really, the way we are with people, that it be our partners, our children, whoever, to see, am I relating to the person in the moment? Or am I relating to the ideal person I want them to be? Or am I relating to how I expect them to be? Once I was working in the garden in France, and it was very hot. And after an hour, and I was hot and everything, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice if Stephen brought me a glass of water? No, first I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a glass of water? Then I thought, wouldn't it be nice if Stephen brought me a glass of water? If Stephen loved me, he would bring me a glass of water. And so finally he arrives, no glass of water, of course. And then I clearly saw what I was doing. I clearly saw that I was so disappointed he did not bring the glass of water. And then I thought, how can he know? How can he be in my mind? So I made a joke to him about what I had been thinking. And now he always asks me, he always brings me a glass of water. It's become a joke. So to see that when we relate to somebody, are we relating to the person or are we relating to the idea of the person? I think we have, you know, I had a friend and she used to have lots of trouble with her partner. And then she said, oh, now it's much better. I said, what happened? She said, I stopped wanting him to be different, you know? And it's very important to see, it doesn't mean you cannot change what is difficult. But if you start by saying, I will love you only if you are not like this. It's saying, basically saying, I don't like this part of you. But what if they say that to you? It's the same. Ooh, like, you know, they only want 2/3 of me. you know, what do I do about this bit? You know, get rid of it, change it. And so I think it's important, love, like creative wise love, if we bring awareness to love, is to really accept fully the person. And that's the greatest gift we can give to a child, to a partner, to a friend. And then from that position of trust, then you can then look at what is difficult. Stephen and myself, we generally get on very well, but we get stressed in airports. So we travel a lot, and so we get stressed. But we have very different survival mechanisms. When we get stressed, he goes slower and I go faster. So for a long time, I thought he was doing it on purpose to annoy me. Until I realized, no, he does not do it because of me, he does it because of him. And now that we realize that's what we do, then we can see each other going like in different modes, and then we try to come a little in the middle. One a little faster, the other a little slower. So in a way to try to see how can I bring this creative awareness also to being in relationship, to being with people, with family, with friends. And then I'll just share a last story. And this is also about creative awareness acceptance and also wanting to repeat. So I love my niece. She was younger, maybe 6 or 7 when this happened, and she often used to come to stay with my mother and then come to spend some time with us. And one day we had worked hard in the garden, and then Stephen and I, we were just resting, listening to Schubert in the living room, very quiet. And then suddenly she comes in, "I am here." And so we look, "Yeah, nice to see you." And said, "Oh, I am going to dance." So we said, "Sure." So she danced for the next 30 minutes on Schubert. I mean, it was not kind of, you know, the Bolshoi, but she danced. She did her thing. And the only thing she needed was that we were watching. So, and we just watched, you know, sometimes she would check, yeah, we're still there, still watching, still, you know, there for you, loving you, supporting you. And so that lasted for about 30 minutes. And then she went down to eat with grandma. And it was a wonderful experience, because it was just being together without adding anything to the experience and just being there for it. And then the next day, very interesting, she wanted me to put the same record. And it did not work. So then she wanted another record. We tried a few, but none worked. It was interesting. She had liked it so much that she wanted to repeat the same experience. But we could not. She could only have it one time. But it does not mean that we cannot have another nice time together. So that's what I wanted to say today. And also just to say that tomorrow at breakfast, once we have served the food, then the silence will be officially broken. And then people can talk. But of course, if some people want to be quiet, then, I mean, there is enough space, and also the meditation room will remain quiet till we do the circle in the middle of the morning. So that's what I wanted to let you know. And see, if you could stay in silence until breakfast, that would be good. So are there any questions or comments? Yeah. The monastery. Okay, I mean, the main reason, I mean, we had two different main reasons. His reason was that he became a monk in the Tibetan tradition, and he was a monk for many years in the Tibetan tradition. Then he came to Korea to practice Zen, because he was interested to practice the questioning. But he never thought to stay more than 3 years. His idea, because he lived as a monk for a while in India, and then he lived as a monk in Switzerland. And in Switzerland, he felt that living as a monk was too strange, too much separation with the people. So his idea, Stephen's idea, had been to come to Korea to practice questioning for 3 years, and then to disrobe anyway and to go back to lay life. Then for myself, I decided to become a nun over 3 days. I thought, why not? That can do this for a year and a half or two, learn different things. And then I stayed 10 years because I thought it was a very nice thing to do. I really learned a lot. And then Master Kuzan died. He died after 9 years. And when he died, the atmosphere in the temple changed very much. Like, what was interesting is when he was there, we did not go to ask him questions every 2 minutes. We only met him rarely when we wanted to. But when he went, it was like a light had gone out of the temple, and then a new master came, which was all right, but so-so. It was okay, but not like the one before. And so then we were asked to stay another year, to Stephen and myself, to help with the Western community. And after a year, we had, you know, the decision to him to go and do whatever, and me to go and do whatever. And then during that year, we kind of thought, yeah, we kind of liked each other, and then things moved on after we disrobed from there. So we basically decided to disrobe for different reasons. he always thought he would do that anyway. And me, I would say it's more because the Master Kuzan died. And then suddenly it became obvious that I wanted to practice in a different way, in a less monastic, in a less cultural way. I think that's what I want. Though I have great respect for Korean Buddhism, and at the moment I am working on a text for Korean Buddhist, I just wanted to do it in a different way. Yeah?
I've got a question about ordinary, actually. I'm so glad you said something about it, that I've been aspiring to ordinariness for some time, mm-hmm. to come off my platform of imagined specialness and so on, and needless difference and so on. But you said a meditative and ethical ordinariness, not just any ordinariness, and I do struggle with that sense I have of alienation, some of it on good grounds, from mass society, from the bombardment of images, which everybody must come to terms in their own way. My ways, obviously I don't manage to avoid them anyway, even without television. So that's why ordinariness or normality is in some way problematic, just because there's so much about the everyday, you know, I'm one of that deserves criticism. So as soon as I, so...
Yeah, there is ordinary and ordinary. It's true. No, it's a good point. It's a very good point. To me, it was more kind of coming back to being an ordinary human being in the fullness of the potential that an ordinary human being can be. So then one don't dream to, because often we have what I would call the heroic complex. I must save the world, or I must be this whatever. But not just this person with this kind of problem and that. To me, it was more kind of looking at it personally. Because then, of course, this ordinary human being then is in a society. And that then is different. Because society, you have society, you have culture, and then you have to decide how much do you want to fit in the culture or not. And I think to me the creative awareness can help us to give us a stability and the openness so that we can pick and choose actually with the society and see in which way we want to engage with it. With back to my meditative and ethical attitude in terms of you don't have to buy it. Though at the moment it possibly there could be some change, but who knows? I mean, until 2 years ago, it all worked on consuming. We were told if we were saving, we were bad guys because we had to consume so people could produce, so we could buy more. This is, but we did not have to buy it. I did not have to buy it. I mean, nobody forced me to consume. I can, it's the same as going shopping, or again, it depends if you live in the town or in the countryside. We're lucky to live in the countryside, so then you have less bombardment. We live in an ordinary little village. So again, it's kind of back to, do I change inside? Do I change the circumstances? Do I try to, not so much that I avoid it, but I don't go into a fight over it unless it has a point. So if you feel strongly, for example, about ecology, then you can try to work on, you know, kind of using less electricity, water, etc. And you can do this yourself, or you can get together with other people to encourage other people to do that. So I think, again, it works at different levels. So it's kind of like, what kind of member of the society do we want to be? Because at one level, as Stephen wrote a book called Alone with Others, at one level we are alone, so we have that ordinariness of being this human being, although we're special because our conditions are different from somebody else's condition. So that's where the difference comes in. And to see how do I want to engage with society, because I am part of society. I'm part of the society in which you have hospital, post office, policeman, shopkeeper, and I participate in it. Whenever I go to Bordeaux once a week, my contribution is to pay the parking. That's my little contribution to the system. you know, and then I might not buy so much because I don't need so much. So again, I think it's kind of like how, to me, it's kind of creatively engaging with the society at the level we can or we want to according to the circumstances and what ourselves we can do.
Your friend's experience, thanks for that answer, just came to mind that your friend's experience with the women making pottery is kind of, like you're saying, thoughts are not so powerful. It's like, who would think that that structure of that would be changed just with a comment?
I mean, what I like to read about, there is this magazine on ecology, a friend of ours produced it, called Resurgence. And my favorite article is people who, in their way, modest way, do something on the ground. To me, that's what I found inspiring. Not being an NGO, but, you know, people, women often, or men, who decide in their village, in their small ways, to do something about the situation. That, to me, is very inspiring. It shows the potential of the human spirit. Yeah? Look, we did it. You see, we did it in a monastery, in a hierarchical model. And that works well in some way because you have a top, everybody is in their places, and there is no questioning, no consensus, no democracy. So you like it or you don't, so you stay or you go. That's easy. Then you have what you have more in the Western society nowadays. These consensual, democratic, equal communities. And in the modern world, it's very difficult. It's extremely difficult. So I would recommend it as a training. Unless you have a temperament which really fit being with each other. Stephen has a good temperament to be with in community. He is very good with that. Me, middle. But he's very good. So I think it's also the temperament of the people. You might, because we had the, I lived for 6 years in a Buddhist community, and I could see sometimes we had this harmonious time, and then tough time, harmonious time, tough time. That's where a Buddhist meditator did not make any difference, you know. Then we tried to do this project of called the Sharpam College, where Stephen had the great idea. You know, you would have everything. You know, you would have the meditation, you would have the teaching, you would have the learning, you would have the social work outside, you would have work in the garden, you would have community meeting, you would have a facilitator, but you really had everything. It could make happy a meditator, we thought. But everything we provided, there was no problem with that. But the problem was people living together. And there was an arc. It was very interesting. We saw it, we did 4 years of it, and we saw each time the same thing happen. First there was, now it's also some people have a word for it. The first was kind of like what we call the honeymoon period for 3 months. The first 3 months, they did not really know each other, mm-hmm. and they were happy to be together, and you know, yeah. So they were more loose and open. Then the next 3 months, back to I am me, this is my space, this is my way, and I am not going to budge. And then the last 3 months were good because they knew they were going to go away and not meet them again. And within that process, I also saw that some people, generally it was about 10 to 12, 13 people, and always, every year we had the same. Every year we had at least 8 people who were really into being communal and nice and friendly and trying and learning, and 2 or 3 who could not, basically, it's very interesting, wanted to live in community because they thought it would be good for them, but they were incapable of doing it. Physically, physiologically, mentally, psychologically, they could not do it. They could not do it. Just being with people put them on edge. It doesn't mean they were not nice people. They were very nice people. I'm still friends with them. But they could not. They could not be communal. It was impossible for them. And we noticed it again and again. And often it's the people who want to live in community, unfortunately. And so it was very interesting for me to observe this, because I was in the middle of this, trying to make this thing work. So, yes, if you want to start a community, if you want to join a community, good idea. It will be a good training. Because, you see, it's a modern world. The modern world develops us to be individual. The modern world does not develop us to cooperate and to share. We're supposed to be distinctive. We're supposed to be special. We're supposed to compete. This is all our education. This is what society, I mean, I think maybe it was different in the kibbutzim, in the house for children, but this is something I'm very interested in. But anyway, this society now, and it's not just in the West. In the East, I went back to Korea 4 years ago, and amazing. Before, they were in the meditation hall, 20 people living together the whole time, sleeping, eating, everything together, 20 people, which for Westerners is just unthinkable. I mean, I did it, but it's special. You have really want to meditate to do it as a Westerner. And what they want now, I went to a temple and they were building this huge thing. And I said, why do you need this huge building? And they look at me and say, to build kind of rooms for 2 people at a time. They don't want to live together anymore. So even the Koreans, who are really raised to live together, start to be, I would say, infected by this modern individualism, which has good point. But modern individualism does not teach us how to live together. So then it's really a training. And I would say, personally, I learned a lot. It's like a fast track. If you want to learn to apply creative awareness, live in community. This is a fast track to apply it. Because you have to share the space, people have different views, different ideas. And also, you will be with people in a different way. That's what's beautiful. No, community, I lived in a long time, I like them. But if you live in community with people, even if you don't like them, you care for them. And when you meet them again, oh, you love them so much. You made a bond for life because you shared a life together. And now we don't share life with strangers. We share life with our family on a very fixed role. But sharing life with strangers is very interesting. So I would say yes, it's a good idea, but it's very difficult in practice over time, for a long time, unless you have a certain tendency. It's very tiring. It's very energy consuming, even if you don't have any trouble. When we left the community after 6 years to just move downstairs, we did not move far, to be just by ourselves, Stephen and I. Stephen was so worried. He'd lived in community for nearly 20 years. He thought, you know, just the 2 of us, I mean, it's going to be so boring and so, you know, he thought, you know, it would really be not fun. And the first morning, we had breakfast, just the 2 of us. We looked at each other and we said, it's so nice, so peaceful. And what happened is that when you live in community, within your psyche, you integrate the other people, so that you're always conscious of the other people. And when I just leave, we just went down, not far, and suddenly there was not all these people in me. I did not worry about them, I did not think of them. I was very interesting experience, very interesting experience. So personally nowadays, if I can finish with that point, personally what I would recommend, and it's a movement that is now taking off in Sweden, in America, it's co-housing. That I think is a way of the future for community. Do you know about co-housing? Is when you create houses which are separate, so you don't have to live together. Maybe it's like a kibbutz, who knows? But it's more ecologically minded. So you kind of eat together, you share the washing machine, you share things so that you reduce the ecological imprint. You have the possibility of being together, the possibility of being separate. And to me, I think this is the way to go. And I know many communities like that which work very well, because it's kind of, it's a different way of being together in individual house and sharing things, and it's, to me, that's a way of the future.
You know, I would like to suggest that if anyone is interested in trying a spiritual community for 1 week, come to serve on a retreat in the kitchen, like the volunteers here, right? And it's an experience of a community with a common spiritual practice and also a common task, and with caring for each other, but also sometimes difficulties. And if anyone wants to find out about yourself, if it's right for you or not, then do come and serve on a retreat.
Good idea. Okay, yes. I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
It seems that we, all the time speak negative about the modern life. Do you see some positive?
Totally. I think modern life is great. I would not want to live even 50 years ago. I feel I'm very fortunate to be in this modern life. No. In terms of consuming, I think there is a little of a problem. Personally, also, individualism is good. There is good, it's like anything. There is good point and there is bad point. But in terms of modern life, no, I think, you know, the scientific outlook is great. Education is great. Human rights, I'm all for it. Ecology, fantastic. The fact that not everywhere, but the level of people welfare has arisen. I think personally, I think it's a nice modern world. But at the same time, at the moment, we are in a big economic crisis, and I wonder if they will do it or not. I doubt it, but it would have been nice that they use the opportunity to. I am very interested in economics, and so I read lots of things about economics. And I think it's a very, I mean, I think each time is an interesting time. But I think, you know, we have, especially women, I would say, as a woman, I'm really happy to have been born in this modern life in France, in a nice family. That was my luck. No, I think it's wonderful. And nowadays, I think with the internet, I think it's also very interesting in terms of the way with meditation, people can really do lots of things. I'm very interested in, you know, I do classes with Skype. I do teaching with Skype. I also, there is this wonderful, if you're interested, this wonderful website in America for meditators. And recently they did a 3 months sitting where everybody could join and would sit every day, whatever time you wanted. And I think 7,000 people joined from all over the world. Wow. To do the 3 month sit. And then you started to have groups, like the group for the people interested in aging, group interested in social work, group interested in relationship, groups in art. Then you had the people who were telling each other about their meditation, or I was so sleepy, what do you think about sleepiness, somebody else. And it's a wonderful website. They asked me to kind of help a little with it in my very modest way, and I felt this was a very nice, you know, modern thing, because I have a friend who is in Paris and she feels a little isolated, and so I told her to join it, and she said, oh, it's great, you know, there is teaching every week I can listen to, and then I can see what people are interested in, I can ask questions, and she feels connected. So no, personally I'm all for the modern life, but possibly little improvement of ecological consumption and, you know, certain the way we treat a certain category of people, and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was an anarchist in my past life. It's called tricycle.com. So it's tricycle, like a tricycle, you know, tricycle. And there is a magazine called Tricycle, and so that's their website. And now it's really, you know, lots of blogs, lots of things happening. It's very interesting. And it's for all Buddhists, Zen, Theravada, Tibetan. Yes. You know, this is meditation. It will have certain strong effect, you know, that way it won't have the strong effect. So, again, you know, it's what works for you. You could just use the questioning when you are outside, and when you are, you know, sitting in meditation, you could just use what seems to help you to have less agitation in the thought. And if it's a breath, it's totally complementary together. So. No, it's seen as an antidote to thoughts. That it's seen as a blade that does not repress, but that just cuts through without leaving any stickiness.
Can I just, about the question again, you told the story a couple of days ago when you were on one of your 3-month breaks that you went to visit this master, and you asked him, you had one question, and
yes,
he said,
yeah,
how can I make my question more vivid?
Yes.
What did you mean by that? What does it mean to make your question more vivid?
That it's not repeated like a mantra. That the sensation, so that the sensation is alive. Because there is, this is a kind of the terminology of Zen meditation. And they call that, sometimes they say there is a dead word and a live word. Dead word is when you, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is that, which doesn't lead you anywhere. And the alive word is when really you say it. And it's kind of like, what is this? And you're really present to it. You really say it with the whole body and mind. And it's kind of like this sensation.
And often when you say it, it can be a situation where you're not focused on anything in particular, or it can also be a situation where something comes up very particular and you're focused on that. And the question is, what is it, this particular thing?
So traditionally there is no reference point. But if you've done awareness meditation for a while, then you will use it in the second way. And I think this is perfectly fine. I think adaptation is a good thing. Okay? So, thank you very much. Then some walking meditation, and then the final sitting for today.